I am Anne-Marie Schubert, and this is Inside the Crime Files.
Welcome to Inside the Crime Files with Anne-Marie Schubert podcast. I am Anne-Marie Schubert, and this podcast takes listeners inside and behind the scenes of the investigation and the prosecution of some of the most horrific and notorious criminal cases in California history. We also take an opportunity to examine unique techniques, innovative ideas, and truly inspirational stories that have come out of many of these cases. One of those cases is the People versus Mario Garcia. It's a case from 2005 in Placer County involving what we call a no-body homicide. It involved the disappearance of Christy Wilson from the Thunder Valley Casino. In this episode, we will focus on how forensic evidence and DNA helped identify and convict the killer, Mario Garcia, for the murder of Christy Wilson. I am honored today to be joined by Christy's mother, Debbie Boyd, two lead investigators, Nuno Tavares and Don Murchison, as well as Placer County District Attorney, Morgan Geyer. Welcome, everybody. And if I can ask each of you to introduce yourself, and I'll start with Debbie.
Good morning. I'm Debbie Boyd, Christy Wilson's mother.
Good morning. Morgan Geyer, Placer County District Attorney. It's an honor to be here this morning. Thank you.
Good morning. Nuno Tavares. I'm a lieutenant with the Placer County DA's office. And Emery, thank you for inviting us to your podcast.
Don Murchison, retired investigator with the Placer County Sheriff's Department and the Placer County District Attorney's Office.
All right. Welcome, everybody. Before we kind of start with what happened to Christy, Debbie, I just want to ask you, maybe just tell the listeners a little bit about what was Christy like?
Oh my goodness. She was a very tenacious, driven young woman, always a goal setter. And whenever she sought out to do something, she, you know, was known to do whatever she had to do to accomplish it. She was very, very close to her family. And so when Christy disappeared, it was just a shock because literally, you know, she was my commute buddy. Whenever I was commuting up and down the 101 and down in the Bay Area to work, every day we'd have a conversation just about our day. And so it was just shocking when multiple days went by and I hadn't heard from her. Loved her family, loved her friends, very, very giving young woman.
Let's talk about the crime a little bit, and I'll kind of hand this over to Nuno and Don Murchison. This occurred in October of 2005, correct?
Correct.
Okay, so if the two of you, and I'll start with you, I'll start with Don, since you were at the sheriff's office, just walk us through kind of the circumstances of her disappearance.
On October 5th of 2005, Christy went to the Thunder Valley Casino to gamble. And on October 4th, she went to the casino. On October 5th, around 1:15 in the morning, she ended up leaving the casino with a gentleman that was unidentified at the time. On October 7th of 2005, Sacramento Police Department received a call from her then boyfriend, Danny Berlando, that reported her missing and then contacted her parents. Sacramento Police Department worked on the case, put out a missing persons flyer, interviewed Danny, and started doing follow-up. And on October 9th, they realized that this probably would fall within the Placer County Sheriff's Department's jurisdiction because her car and the last time she was seen was at the Thunder Valley Casino. Her vehicle was still in the parking lot. So they reached out and contacted the Placer County Sheriff's Department, who then ultimately took over the investigation and started working on the case.
And then, Nuno, let me just kind of ask you, at some point, clearly Mr. Garcia was identified as the person that was walking out with Christy, correct?
Correct.
And then what got law enforcement to the point where he was arrested for her murder?
So shortly after he was identified, he was interviewed by Sergeant McDonald with the Placer County Sheriff's Office, provided some inconsistent statements based on his whereabouts and what Thunder Valley Casino's surveillance team had given us. So with those inconsistent statements and finding some forensic evidence in the vehicle, we were able to focus in on Mario Garcia as our primary suspect. And over a period of some time, And there was only a couple of days. The Sheriff's Department team wrote some search warrants, and we started getting into writing those search warrants, getting into his house, into his vehicle, into his electronics, and it became clear that Mario was hiding something.
To be clear, part of the reason that the focus was on him fairly immediately was because he was seen on video leaving the casino with Christy, correct?
Correct. As Don mentioned, they left at about 1:15 in the morning. And the visual that we have, and it was all over the media, is both Mario and Christy walking out the east entrance of the casino. They both point in the directions of their vehicles, and they start to walk towards Mario's car. And unfortunately for us, there was a rotational camera above Mario's car that had just cleared the car. And so we couldn't see what was happening there, but we can tell as they're walking out that he's guiding her along, and they disappear into the darkness.
I'm going to go to Don Murchison. His nickname for the listeners is Murch. So if I slip up, that's why.
Murch is fine.
Murch, one of the things that became a critical piece of evidence in the investigation and the trial was the fact that Mario Garcia had done a number of Google searches on his computer. Can you kind of tell the listeners what those were?
Yes, he had looked at, he conducted Google searches on his work computer for DNA evidence, specifically blood typing and blood collection. He also had done searches for date rape drugs and the effects of date rape drugs.
And during the course of the investigation and the trial, there was a significant amount of forensic evidence that was used at the trial. I'm just going to, first of all, give a shout out to the lead prosecutor on this case, who's Garen Horst. Garen Horst is now a judge on the Placer County Superior Court. The case was tried in Sacramento. I had the honor of being asked to help with the forensic evidence, but I will ask, really either you, Nuno, or Don, just to kind of summarize what the physical evidence was that was utilized at the trial that ultimately convicted him of the murder.
During the trial, we presented evidence related to some injuries that Mario had on him. He had significant injuries, both on his face and chest. Appeared to have scratch marks on his face and chest. Additionally, on his vehicle, we located a hair on the outside passenger door handle and a hair in the trunk of the vehicle. That same trunk also came equipped with two trunk mats, a bottom trunk mat and a top trunk mat. Both those trunk mats were missing. A forensic examination of the hair found in the trunk and a hair found on the passenger door handle came back to a full profile match to Christy Wilson. Going into the vehicle, we found hairs on the floorboard of the vehicle that did not have a root ball on them, but they were a mitochondrial match. So a partial match to Christy Wilson. On the back passenger seat, right on the edge of the seat where it meets the door area. When we were examining the vehicle, it was pretty clear that the vehicle had been thoroughly cleaned. It was washed when we located it, and the inside of it had been vacuumed. The area on the seat where it met the door, a passenger door on the rear behind the driver's side, had been missed. You could see where the vacuum had missed that area. In that area, we located 8 basic pinhead sized drops of presumptive positive blood, or what was appeared to be blood. That came back a mixture of Christy Wilson and Mario Garcia's DNA. On the door handle on the passenger side, in the door socket where you open the door, we found DNA matching Christy Wilson and Mario Garcia. And on the passenger door in the rear near the bottom area, we actually found DNA that was solely Christy Wilson's, which was very important in the case in regards to transfer evidence.
So pretty significant amount of forensic evidence, even though this case was a what we call a no body homicide. And I want to just Before I ask kind of Morgan about what is it like, you know, to have a no-body homicide, you know, Debbie, let me just go to you. I mean, last time you speak to her is in early October. How many days before she went missing?
Two.
Okay.
Two, yeah.
So for you as a mom, I mean, when you found out she was missing, you know, what was that like? And then what efforts did you, I know your husband is a retired police officer, Pat, what kinds of things were going through your mind? And then what did you guys do to try to help find her?
Yeah, well, initially we received a call from a boyfriend that Christy was in the process of breaking up with. And he called us, this two nights before she went, well, he called us a couple nights after she'd gone missing and said, you know, I'm going to file a missing persons report. Because the relationship had been tumultuous, when we received that call, the first thought was he's upset and the last dig will be, let's get her parents riled up. And so, but mother's intuition is real, because as soon as Pat hung up the phone with him, something in my gut just said, this isn't right. And so my husband being in law enforcement, you know, in the background, I could often hear conversations, you know, that he might have had on the phone or what have you. And I asked him, is there such a thing as a welfare check? And if that's just checking on, you know, somebody's residence, could you call, and do you know anybody at Sacramento? Could you call Sacramento and ask them as a courtesy to just do a welfare check? And I really pushed him to do it, and he called, and two officers from SAC PD had called back and said that they were, you know, that they were aware and that they were going over to the residence. And then they said they'd call us back. Well, they did. And they said that everything looked normal, and but that they were working all night and that they would call us in the morning. And it was the next morning, true to their word, they did call us, and they'd said they had found Christy's car at Thunder Valley Casino. And it appeared that nobody had gone into the car for multiple days. It was at that moment that I really got shook up, because that was not like her at all. And immediately thereafter, we knew that Christy had an interview. It was a final interview with a new employer, and she was supposed to go in and sign her offer letter that Friday. One thing Christy was is very punctual, and for her to end up being a no-show for a meeting that was that important was not her at all. I mean, she would have shown up. So what I said is, you know what, I'm going to wait until after she's had that interview. And if she doesn't call me, then something's really up. In the meantime, for some reason, the employer right away knew her character was to be right on top of things. And the employer actually contacted me as an emergency contact, saying, we've changed the location of this interview. We've been trying to reach Christy for multiple days, and there's been no response. And at that point, we are all desperately trying to call her. And then her voicemail box ends up being full. And so we knew at that moment something definitely was wrong.
Morgan, first of all, for the listeners' purposes, you were not the DA at the time that this incident occurred. You obviously became the DA, I think, in April of 2020. But you're a career prosecutor. You've done homicides for many years. The credit on this case clearly goes to Garen Horse in terms of being the trial prosecutor, but what is it like to try a case that's called what we call it, you know, a no-body homicide? Maybe explain, what does that mean, and what does it take to actually convict somebody of that?
Thanks, Anne-Marie. Yeah, no-body homicides are challenging. I don't know, rare is a term, I guess I would say they are becoming more common with advent and advancements in technology. Our ability to solve no-body homicides are becoming better and better, but they are challenging for prosecutors. And on a very basic level, a prosecutor has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that someone is dead, whether their body is present at a crime scene or not. So if you don't have a body, you now have to prove that someone is dead, which means you have to overcome the speculation that someone voluntarily vanished. They chose to run away. They chose to disappear. So things that are not necessarily critical when you have a body at a crime scene, things about someone's life in the past or their routines or their habits now become absolutely critical to a no-body homicide because you have to prove that this person did not just choose to go away. So you have to examine what's often called the footprint of life, the things about us as human beings that just show that we want to stick around. We have obligations. We have financial obligations. We have personal obligations. We have, on a very human level, we have hopes. We have dreams. We have things, large and small, that we're looking forward to. And those kinds of things become absolutely critical in a no-body homicide to show, look, this person is no longer here. And this is a complete, utter disruption of their normal daily life. This wasn't some sort of plan on the part of the victim. This is something that represents them but just being yanked from life. And we can demonstrate that by showing, look, they had appointments coming up, and Christy's a perfect example. Someone who's punctual, someone who, you know, is always adhering to deadlines and doesn't want to be late and has things that she's looking forward to, and all of a sudden those things are being missed. So they are a different kind of homicide case from the traditional, where you start with the body and work backwards. Here you don't have that. So it really is takes thinking outside of the box, and you were absolutely right that Garen Horst, the prosecutor at the time, just did a phenomenal job of bringing that into a clear picture for the jury in this case.
And Debbie, I met you probably sometime in the middle of 2006 when the case went to trial, and I was handling some of the DNA evidence in the case. And since that time, we've known each other for a very long time. But I want to just ask, you know, the investigators and Debbie, obviously from the time that she went missing until Garcia was convicted in September of 2006, there was multiple efforts, searches to try to find her. And maybe you can just kind of summarize, like, what did that entail? Because then I want to move to kind of after he was convicted and the pursuit of finding her after that. So
well, initially, we were asked by Placer County to hold off on doing any civilian searches because, you know, it was so critical in the first couple of weeks. And so once we got the clearance to do searches, we were every weekend for, it seemed, months. We were up in Placer County. We were fortunate enough to have upwards of 200 volunteers coming out and searching all over Placer County. Unfortunately, none of those searches ended up favorably. We never did find Christy, but it helped to just rule out, you know, that we had looked at every area we could possibly think of. And then it got to the point where, you know, without any kind of a lead or anything, you know, we had to get to the point that we had to get realistic. We couldn't just be asking people to go for a walk, right? We, you know, people's time was precious. And so at that point, up until close to trial, we were searching almost every weekend.
The searches were intense. The county's large, a lot of rural area for listeners that don't know Placer County, while Lincoln, where Thunder Valley is a populated area and your typical suburban area. Mario lived just outside of Auburn, which is extremely rural and continues to be more rural as you head up into the mountains. So there were a lot of searches done through trial. The focus was the trial. As DA Geyer talked about, it's a huge challenge. And so the focus was on getting the case through trial, and there wasn't a lot of searching going on. I can tell you, I had a box on my desk from the day I got this, was brought onto this case in 2005, and that box stayed on my desk. Actually, it's still there, and it was some of the areas that Dawn and I wanted to follow up and do other searches and kind of plan where we were going from there after the trial. There was one quote I kept on my desk on November 22nd of 2006. Pat Boyd, Christy's stepfather, was interviewed by the SACB, And he said, it's hard to put this to rest without putting her to rest. And those are one of the quotes that stayed in that box and kind of continue to help Don and I and drive us to continue searching for Christy and looking back at old leads, looking back at areas that were searched that maybe were done quickly, were done with older technology. And so that effort, while we weren't searching every day, of course, Don and I both moved on to other work, maintained in the back of our minds and as sometimes on the forefront of our minds as we continued with a variety of searches throughout the years.
For the listeners' purposes, Garcia was convicted of Christy's murder in September of 2006. He was sent off to prison. He appealed, and there's, you know, you can read these appellate opinions. He claimed his innocence all along. But you, Nuno, and Detective Murchison, and Debbie, everybody still looked, even though he was convicted. And so, Dawn, I want to kind of turn to you and ask you, so, you know, this is 15 years ago. Okay, he's convicted 15 years ago. In law enforcement, you never give up, even though he's been convicted. And just maybe walk the listeners through, like, since the time of his conviction, just kind of examples of the efforts that you all made to try to find her.
During the, you know, Nuno and I, you know, the biggest thing is that we knew that she was out there. And we had talked a lot, and especially in the trial about, you know, trying to find Christy at this point was like looking for a needle in the haystack, but not knowing where the haystacks were located. And so that's what our job was, to try and figure out locations that made sense to us. Prior to the trial, there had been approximately 24 searches done in Placer County, both through law enforcement and civilian efforts through Debbie Boyd and family and the law enforcement agencies that came in to help out. Searches were done with helicopters and mounted patrol. ATVs are out there, people on foot. There was even regular civilian search groups that we were monitoring on different social media sites that were doing searches. So taking that into account of areas that had been searched, you know, and another thing that was also very helpful for us and things that we had done is Nuno and I actually teach for POST. And so peace officer standard in training, Institute of Criminal Investigation. So
teaching police officers, that's what you're doing.
Yes, basically teaching police officers. And through that, we would talk about the case. And then at the end of it, we would discuss things that we were still looking for, such as her clothing and articles of clothing and things that she may have had with her. And so we would, during times, get calls from various agencies and have them, you know, confirm or check for us. And so that was one of the things that we would regularly do. Patrol would also receive calls, and so we'd follow up on those calls. But specifically for Nuno and I is we just went back and looked at the search areas. And we also went back and talked to various of his family members and just tried to get a more historical background of things that Mario Garcia may have talked about in his life, places he liked to visit, places he maybe if he hunted or fished or places he went for on vacation. And we tried to see if they would have been in the area that would make sense for us to look at. We also had specific information. One of the examples was up at Scott's Flat Lake in Nevada County. We contacted the Nevada County Sheriff's Department and the Placer County Sheriff's Department dive team, along with the Nevada County Sheriff's Department dive team, approximately 30 members, went out for 2 days. We conducted a search of the shoreline of the lake, both in the water and outside on the edge of the shore. There was approximately 200 searchers out there also assisting with that search. We had another search up in Dutch Flat, where we had approximately 200 searchers searching off and on for 4 days. We also had some thought that she may have been based on some paperwork that we found on his computer and also in his house regarding attorney-client privileges. One of his acquaintances or friends was a local attorney. And with their permission, we ended up doing a couple searches on their property including one that was their septic system. We actually went out there and physically had their entire septic system pumped out and transported to another location where Nuno and I and the Placer County road crew sifted through approximately 1,500 gallons of septic, trying to see if we could locate Christy.
To take your listeners a little bit behind the scenes to follow up with what Don just said, we had over 340 hours of jail calls that we'd monitored with Mario, with conversations mostly with his family. And I can tell you at least over 40 times, Mario talked about water, rain, and he even asked one of his friends who was American Indian to do a rain dance. He wanted rain. He wanted a lot of water. So one of the areas of focus were seasonal creek beds or anywhere that water can potentially, in Mario's own words, wash away evidence. He used that statement back in the 70s. So that was one of the areas through our vast map here that we would search were areas of any kind of water or water can run through.
Well, I recall having conversations, I think, with both of you about you guys were trying to map his cell phone usage and where he was going and the towers he was hitting. And I mean, I think for the listeners, you know, it's extraordinary what you all did, even after he was convicted. I mean, the amount of time to find her is really, it's really a testament to law enforcement. But let me kind of move forward a little bit. Debbie, you started to have contact with Garcia. So he's in prison now. If my knowledge is right, is somewhere around 2017, correct, he started to write you letters from prison. And maybe just tell the listeners, first of all, what's that like as a mom? And why did you, if at all, why did you engage with him?
Well, Mario was watching news frequently while he was in prison, and he caught a glimpse of an interview I did, and also he was watching social media a lot, and he saw an interview I did with CBS 13 in Sacramento, and in that interview I had shared that, you know, before my dying day, I would love to have a conversation with Mario. Part of that at the time was just my last ditch effort to try and do something to generate maybe another lead on the case or just do something. I was at my wit's end. And Mario did actually see that interview and he began writing. He wrote first to a civil attorney and he sent the letter and said, could you please give this to Mrs. Boyd? That civil attorney did forward the letter to me. I read it and I sat on it because as I read the letter, I thought, in typical Mario fashion, he's trying to manipulate. It was so clear in the words that he was using. He was trying to lead me to believe that he had had a spiritual experience while in prison and in essence had found God and that he was sorry. But what he was conveying in those letters, which you know really ate at me, was that he was insinuating that he was involved to the extent of involved in her murder, but that it didn't happen the way that it had been portrayed at trial. But he didn't allude to anything more than that. So as a mom, I'm sitting here thinking he's just admitted he killed her, but without really saying it. And so I didn't respond to him. Then he sent a second letter. And in that second letter, and he sent it directly to the civil attorney. In that second letter, he went so far as to ask the civil attorney, are you giving these letters to Mrs. Boyd? And oh, by the way, if you don't have her address, here's her address.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So, you know, anybody can find people's address, I guess, these days. But he did. He wrote the address down and the civil attorney passed that on to me. And at that point, I started crafting letters and then decided, you know, before I send this letter, I should probably contact Don and Nuno and pass these letters on to them. And at that point I did. And we then came together and they gave me some suggestions of appropriate edits that might make my response a bit more powerful. And so I went ahead and eventually I sent that letter. And basically, in so many words, I told Mario that, you know, he's the key to the answers. And at this point, you know, from my perspective, he should think about his own family and forget me, but think about my other daughter, Christy's eldest sibling, Stacy. And that I think that we have a responsibility to bring peace to both of our families, our children, right, and that this isn't fair. And that at this point, it's really up to him. And that I really don't have anything more to say. It's really up to him. And at that point, he then began writing to, from my understanding, writing to Placer County directly. And I kicked myself a few times because I just kept vacillating between, you know, I would do anything to find Christy. I don't care what I have to do. And then in the quiet of the night, I sat there and I thought, oh my God, this guy's manipulating me. Debbie, what are you doing? Is this what Christy would want you to do? And I thought, you know, I'm playing with the devil here. I need to stop. I just need to stop and put this into the hands of Placer County and let their capable investigators, you know, take this and let's see what happens with it.
You get appointed to the DA position in April of 2020, right? So at what point did you become aware and engaged with Detectives Murchison, Detective Nuno, or Tavares, and Debbie?
Well, I would say from within weeks of my arrival at the Placer County DA's office, but let me back up. This case is different than most criminal cases, the effect that it had on our community. I was born and raised in the area at the time, as you know, I was working for you. But this case, everyone in the area knew about it. People in Sacramento knew about it. People all around, everyone knew that Christy was still out there. And this case, even though justice was sort of technically brought down on the defendant, there was still a hole in the community as well, not knowing where she was. So this case was very present in my mind when I got here because I knew there were still ongoing search efforts. So within a couple of weeks, of my arrival, Nuno and Don and I had sort of talked about, all right, we need to sit down and, you know, bring me up to speed on where we are, what are the latest on the efforts. And it's not an ongoing criminal investigation, so it's different than most cases. We have, you know, lots of those going on, but this was something that was still very important. So my first step was to sit down and sort of read the case file and understand what the case, what had happened in detail. And then one day I'm coming back into my office and my secretary hands me a note that says Debbie Boyd had called. And Nuno had said, hey, Debbie's gonna reach out to you just to touch base. And I had been waiting for that call because I wanted to talk to Debbie because I knew much about her from the news and I had heard about her and I couldn't wait to establish a relationship. In the meantime, I had seen a stack of letters that Mr. Garcia had written to the DA's office, to the then DA. And he was basically offering up a location of Christie's remains in exchange for some sort of release from prison. And it was going back and forth, and he wanted to call it a conviction review. And he clearly, as Debbie had said, wanted to indicate his responsibility in her death, but not her murder. And that's a, you know, a big legal distinction. He clearly was trying to minimize and manipulate his responsibility for her murder. And that's all it was his murder of her. And it was, there were so many variables of what he was proposing about how the remains would be examined and what those would show. And we all know who've been in the business that after this period of time, anything was going to be somewhat inconsequential and not demonstrating clearly whether the remains wouldn't show necessarily murder or not. And without that element of control, we're not going to release this man just based on finding the remains. And Debbie was put into this terrible position because I called her and said, look, I'm reading these letters where he's clearly negotiating and manipulating the location of the remains. And I don't like it. And I don't want to engage with him because this is just going to end up in his release. And I said, Debbie, I want to write him a letter and tell him, hey, there's a new guy in town. We don't care. I'd like to tell him to pound sand, and I'd like to let Don and Nuno do what they do best, which is go find people. And she was in this position of having to say, we are risking never finding Christie's remains. That risk versus the risk of letting Mario out. And that's a position that is unimaginable for anyone. And Debbie is in it, having to say, okay, tell him we're done here. I would rather him remain in prison than let this man out. And that choice, I mean, it was difficult for me on a human level to wrap my brain around it. So I wrote him a letter back and said, you have one little ounce of humanity left that you can show us, and that's to show us the remains, but we're not negotiating it. So when you decide that you want to tell us that, that's fine. But in the meantime, we don't need to hear from you from now on. And then I said, Debbie, let's just let them go do what they got to do. They had a bunch of plans. They had a bunch of ideas on what to do. So then Nuno and Don came in, briefed me on a bunch of ideas. And from there, we sort of developed a plan of attack on, all right, what are we going to do next?
While these letters were going back and forth and through the years, we had the Department of Corrections, we were in contact with them, and they'd found multiple phones in Mario's cell. Mario had been able to get these phones illegally. So we took those phones and examined them. And sure enough, he was having conversations with a variety of people, including writing some of these notes and that kind of the letters and that kind of thing. We went back to, again, the case file. And like Don mentioned, we had been doing interviews with Garcia's family, with both his ex-wife and his now adult kids. And Don and I knew that those kids were present and there, as well as his wife, during the days after Christie went missing, to the point where Mario got arrested. And these kids were young. We knew that they probably had seen something that was of value to us, but it wasn't apparent. So our first step was to go back and re-interview all three of them, which we did. We interviewed them multiple times, but specifically in 2020, Don and I had talked to Chris, which is Mario's oldest son. And we specifically took him down based on our investigation. And we knew that the time that Mario had alone would have been the Friday and Saturday after Christie went missing. Christie went missing on a Wednesday. Mario was injured due to some injuries he had as a result of this crime. And so we knew that there was a period of time that he was alone. So we walked Chris through that time, and something that stuck out particular to him was on Saturday. So just 4 days after Christie went missing, he had a pretty significant soccer game, the big soccer family. And Mario was out working on his property, which is not uncommon. He was on a tractor that he borrowed from a neighbor. That tractor had a small scoop on it, but Mario was out moving bark around. Again, he was doing it all over his property. So Don and I zeroed in on that. We'd had this conversation multiple times, but specifically, the thing that was odd was that Dad was not going to his soccer game. Mario did not miss any of his kids' soccer games. So we keyed in on that. A couple of days later, we actually took Chris up to the property and had Chris show
us. He didn't live there anymore, right?
They did not. No, another family lived there. And Don and I had already stopped and built rapport with the new family, with the new family that was living there. So we had already talked to them, and they knew very well that they moved into an area where potentially a crime had committed. So they were very welcoming and very warm to us the entire time. So we went back up there. Chris showed us the area where Dad was working. It was right next to the driveway, right next to the family property, not an area that, you would think that anyone would bury a body, but nonetheless, that became an area of interest. Don and I we had an aha moment. We spoke with the homeowner, and the homeowner, there's a pond on the property that's shared with another neighbor. That pond was ruled out fairly early as an area where potentially Christie's body can be. This area had been searched by the sheriff's department earlier extensively. The whole property had. It's about 4.5 acres up in just outside of Auburn. And the aha moment was when the property owner said that the pond was leaking and that water was going underneath the driveway, underneath this area where Chris said dad was working, out to a little pasture. And that came up because the homeowner said, hey, when you guys are out here looking, be careful because there's an area that's really muddy. The water comes through there. We went back to those jail calls and remember that Mario had talked about water so many times. So that became our big aha moment. Is it possible that Christie's actually on this property and that the water that's coming out of that pond is what he'd been talking about over the years, over the jail calls? I went back to looking at aerial photos over the property, looking for, you know, areas where there was disturbed soil. And I looked through Google Earth over the years, and I found one area of interest, but it wasn't great. The imagery wasn't great. So in that time, I went back to Morgan and said, hey, I would love to go back to the property and use any technology available to us today that we can rule out that Christie is not on this property with the technology that's available today. And Morgan, of course, gave us the blessing and the budget to go and conduct our searches. So Donna and I continued on the path of working with other federal partners to create imagery, look for imagery to show any disturbed area, because it's 4.5 acres and it's a large property. So we started that. I got hold of a ground penetrating radar company, which you'll probably hear me refer to as GPR. And basically it's used mostly in the archaeological setting, and where they use a machine that looks like a radar that is on a baby stroller. And they walk that over the property looking for disturbances in the soil. So we had multiple conversations with them. We reached out to the National Geographic Service, or Geological, excuse me, where they gave us some readings on the soil. Some neighbors had told us that in order to dig even just simply a tree, they had to use jackhammers in certain areas because there's a lot of rock in that area. So Don and I had other areas planned outside of Thunder Valley where we wanted to search, and we definitely wanted to rule out the property. We picked the property just because that's where we were going next. It had been searched. The likelihood that Mario would bring Christie back up to the property where his family was in the middle of the night was probably slim, but nonetheless, we wanted to eliminate that. So we continued with preparing for our search that we identified would be in July of 2020.
Yeah, I was going to say the initial review of the case file, to me, you know, they're still looking for all of these haystacks, and the property is one haystack, and it's a 4-acre haystack to look through. And it wasn't clear, but it seemed to me, reading all about Mario and his history and his activities and his lies, he's a narcissist and he needs to be in control. So when we were trying to eliminate these haystacks, Don and Nuno and I are having these conversations. And the one theme that keeps coming back up is for him to do something with Christie's body in the middle of the night without him being able to control the environment would be very rare. So where can he exert complete control of the situation as best he can? And that's his property. He's not going to go out to the middle of a field, and this is my hindsight of being able to read all about him, and say, okay, it's probably got to be that property. And Nuno and Don had that feeling already, like this is probably where she has to be. It's just, where on these 4 acres could she be? And that's why this water aha moment was just such a integral part of this ultimate discovery.
Yeah, and in regards to that, just talking about the controlling portion of Mario, we saw that in his prior crimes that he had committed. He was a very controlling individual, specifically back to 1979 with his girlfriend at the time, Wendy Ward. He kidnapped and sexually assaulted her. And during that, he was controlling the situation, very controlling of her. And Mario was not a stupid person. He had taken some criminal justice classes, so that we were able to determine that. And he had a knowledge of general evidence and commission of crimes and how to try and cover them up. Another thing that I wanted to talk about what I think is very important is the family did not know at any point where Christy was. Yeah, the wife and the two children. When this case started, again, showing the control over his family, he would not allow his family to speak to us. And it was very clear in the jail calls that Nuno had listened to. He'd listened to almost 340 hours of calls and had a very intimate idea of what Mario was like. And it was very clear that he would not allow his family early on to speak to us. After the trial, Nuno and I reached out to the family and began conversing with them. And it became extremely clear very quickly that they had no idea. Mario had never shared anything with them about where she was located. And they had no idea where she was in regards to, and he didn't tell her where it was and or where she was, where Christy was. And we knew that if they did, they would have shared that with us. So it was very clear that he had not shared that information with anybody at any time.
When Don and I have walked that property numerous times, and especially in 2019 and again 2020, Don had mentioned the injuries that Mario had and the scratches he had. And we had an expert testify trial, a doctor who had made the determination that many of the scratches on his body were created by humans, whereas it was somebody had during the fight. He also had other scratches and poison oak on his body, which we believe were blackberry bushes and poison oak. So during the walk of the property, there was a little creek that runs the perimeter of the property. And in that area, there were a lot of blackberry bushes and there was poison oak. So that was another area that, again, reaffirmed that this is a good area where, based on the evidence that we've looked at over the years, that Christy could potentially be on that property.
Yeah, and I think from the point of the trial, I just recall because of both of the physical evidence of, you know, as Don mentioned, the DNA of Christy on the inside door handles, the blood in the back seat. Her personality that Debbie's described as being a fighter. I mean, it was clear, even though, as Morgan would say, it's circumstantial evidence, right? It was clear and it was argued to that jury that she fought for her life. That's what she did. And she injured him in that process. And she did everything she could to save her own life. But let me go back now. Let's get to the day when you bring this, you call it GPR, ground penetrating radar, out, and correct. Maybe just kind of explain to the listeners what you did and what happened.
Okay, so the company that we worked with, they had done some work in cemeteries, so they had never looked for a clandestine burial site, but they had been able to identify bodies in cemeteries that were unmarked. So that was the experience that they had. The challenge that Don and I had with the GPR operator was that this property wasn't a perfect flat property. There were drop-offs, there were rocks, there were large trees. So it was on a Monday in August, and it was probably 110 degrees. There were smoke, a lot of fires. There were challenges. So we walked the property with the GPR operator, again, told him the little bit of information that Mario's son had told us, but we wanted everything scanned that could possibly be scanned. So over 4 days of heat, fires, and including our operator having to be evacuated from his own home, we worked 10, 11 hour days in slowly scanning and searching the entire property. Over that period of time, he found 8 areas throughout the entire property that had anomalies. In other words, they showed up on his software. There were areas that there was one in particular that was really exciting to him. It was maybe about 6 foot wide by about 4 feet deep, and it was down about 5 feet. We had some other challenges with some, it's close to the airport. So we had challenges with him getting accurate readings on the radar. Don and I had to make a decision about whether his technology whether he wanted us to either go deeper with a less quality image or go more shallow and get a more clear image. So we decided, based on the tools that Mario had available to him, that we would go with the shallow option and get more of a clear image as to what is there. Again, the ground penetrating radar does not show you what's underground. It shows you that there's been a disturbance and that there is some kind of anomaly underground. It could be a pipe, it could be a root, it could be a rock. And sure enough, one of the areas was a large boulder. So at the end of 4 days, he provided us a map of these 8 areas where he found these anomalies. He kind of rated those based on, a human body and based on the technology and the information that he was getting back. So at the end of 4 days, we were ready to search. We had a excavation company on standby, and that took us into Thursday morning.
Don and Nuno and I had a conversation about that too, about, you know, we don't want to elevate hopes and expectations and lead to more disappointment. So we had talked about what would happen if we found her, if we found Christy, but at that time, yeah, we were just hopeful, but cautiously optimistic.
In fact, Don and I had never told Debbie about any of the searches that we were doing throughout the years. We would tell Debbie and the family after the search, but not prior to. And I can tell you another concern Don and I had during this was because this case had so much media attention, we were going back to Mario's house. And our concern was doing this in a way, in a manner that the neighbors wouldn't pick up that law enforcement was on the property, and for sure that the media didn't pick up that we were on the property. We did not want Debbie to hear anything from media, and Debbie can probably speak to that a little bit more.
Yeah, no, I had no idea. I knew that for a couple months they were strategizing on a plan, but never did they discuss with me the property and that there was a plan to search the property.
Okay, so Don, go ahead.
I was just going to say, in regards to that, you know, a lot of times actually Debbie would call us as she would hear news about locations, and she would call us right away and say, hey, do you know about this? Or do you know about that? And, you know, we tried to stay on top of things as best we could, but these were, you know, geographical locations outside Placer County. And we didn't necessarily know about them at times. And so we'd follow up on them. And then we would also initially let her know some of the stuff we were doing or things that we would find. And I think it was really tough on us because we could see that it was getting her hopes up. But yet when it wasn't, you know, her, it wasn't Christy, I think it became very, from my perspective, became difficult on her. And it was at, you know, and also on us. I mean, Nuno and I, it was so hard to be out there and find bones and have hope, and then to find out they were animal bones, which is what happened quite a few times. And so at some point it was just, we had been conducting so many small searches, whether we'd drive out to a location and walk it and see if it was an area we're interested in. Even in regards to going to the property up there, Mario's old property, we had been going up there for almost 2 years and talking to the homeowners and walking the property and looking at things and trying to look back at the evidence of things that we knew, you know, even from the searches that were conducted initially. I mean, there was extensive searching done there with dogs. An arborist came out. I mean, we had lots of the search and rescue team was out there searching the area. So even in regards to that search and preparing for this GPR to come out, Nuno and I were even looking for future. You know, we were out in Lincoln area and we drove around with one of the locals out there that owned or managed 20,000 acres. And we were focused on a certain pond in a certain area. So we had planned this search and then also planned searches from this point on, just to be prepared. And you know, we basically let Debbie know that we were out working, but we didn't specifically share with her exactly what we were doing.
I think it's important for your listeners to know, sort of during this process of strategizing, there are still, as Don was saying, remains being found in other areas, Placer County, El Dorado County. These are rural areas. These are drought conditions. When the lakes recede, remains are found all the time. And every time that happens, it's a could that be Christy? And that's something that Nuno and Don, certainly from an investigative standpoint, have to consider, even when other law enforcement agencies may say, well, no, this is impossible because this is not anywhere near where this occurred. To Debbie, it's a, well, make sure, because who knows? And that's just one more of these like human dynamics going on that Debbie is dealing with. And I think, you know, it just kind of goes to her strength and perseverance through this entire process, that while they're trying to figure out where to search, other remains have to be ruled out because you never know.
Yeah, and I think for many folks, especially Debbie, you know, hope plays tricks on your brain.
And, absolutely. You know, I'd like to mention that one thing that I really commend the investigators for is the fact that they talk straight to me. Where they needed to apply a filter, they did, but they never, ever gave our family false hope. And I think that was really important because, you know, as a victim's family my activity with other victims' families throughout the years, you know, it's very common that we all just hang on the investigators every word. So every update, you're just hanging on to that. So it's so important. And that's what I so appreciate about these guys is they had that sensitivity and were really careful not to provide false hope. So I really thank you for that.
I think an important part of Debbie's involvement in giving back to law enforcement is Debbie teaches with Don and I in that ICI class that Don talked about for homicide detectives, for new homicide detectives. These are veteran people, but they're homicide detectives that are learning how to investigate homicides. And Debbie gives her time and she talks about this case and the impact it had on her and teaching these detectives how to work with victims' families, because Debbie's unfortunately been through the process. In July of 2020, Debbie was teaching a class with us, and part of the presentation allows the detectives to ask questions of Debbie, and Debbie responds. And that one of the questions there plays into the conversation that we had with Morgan. And so it'd be great if we had an opportunity for Debbie to talk about that experience in July of 2020.
Yes, thank you, Nuno. There was a new investigator that was in the class. And one of the questions he asked was, Mrs. Boyd, if Placer County were to ever find your daughter, how would you want to be notified? And I looked over at Nuno and Don and what? And all the years, I had never even thought about that. And I paused for a moment. And the first thing that I said was, please don't ever call me on the phone. And I had to ask myself later, you know, what triggered that response? And I know now what it was. And it was the fact that in all of the other updates that the investigators had given to me, they were always on the phone. And so it was more of a status call is the way I thought. And so I thought, gosh, if they really find her, please tell me in person.
All right, Don, how about you tell us on what happened on that Thursday in August?
So as Nuno mentioned, we had used the GPR unit out there and for the first Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and early Thursday, and had mapped out the terrain. We targeted 8 locations that we felt were possibilities that showed some type of disturbance in the ground. The first place that we focused on was a area that was next to the driveway, underneath some trees. And we had a backhoe operator out there that was very familiar, with Placer County, which was very important in this case, because it's important to understand the soil, and the soil in the area, as Nuno had mentioned, that this particular area had lots of rocks in it and was very difficult to dig in. And so one of the first location that we focused on was a void, and they dug it out, and it was probably about 7 to 8 foot circle, about 6 or 7 feet deep. And it was very soft. And as the backhoe operator is digging in the ground, he can tell how much, how hard it is to dig. And so this was very easy, dug down pretty deep. We were able to check out the area, and it actually had kind of a square. They could tell by the soil that there definitely was a disturbance there. There was probably a square hole there at one time. And based on what we were seeing and some roots in the area, that it was determined that it was more than likely a tree. Basically, at that point, we didn't locate Christy. Okay. The second location that we focused on was basically a gravel road. It was a gravel exit point. The property had a paved driveway, and it had about an 8-foot section of gravel, 8-foot wide by probably 30 or 40 feet long. That was an area where we noticed some disturbance on, so we asked the backhoe operator to start there. And so he dug an area that was about 8 feet wide for probably 30 feet long, varying between 2 to 4 feet deep. As he was digging, he could see that there was some areas of disturbance, or the soil was softer, and then he had run into boulders. And that's one of the boulders that we had hit. It was a very large boulder that was about 2 feet underground in this rectangular area that we had started focused on. So we ruled that area out based on the terrain and the depth that we could dig. And we moved to area 3, which was the area that both Nuno and I had some interest in based on the conversations that we had with Chris in regards to when he was leaving to the soccer game. He recalls seeing his dad working in this general area. He did not see what he was doing. He just saw that he was there on a tractor. And again, for us, that was important, but for Chris, it didn't really stand out until we started talking to him about specifically what he was doing on those days, because his dad worked on that tractor on the property all the time. So we focused on that area, and it was probably about a 6-foot wide, probably 6 foot wide by roughly maybe 30 feet long. In that area, it was right adjacent to the paved driveway, and there was some bark and some bark in that area under a tree. So we started digging in that area on the far end, closer to a chicken coop and a tree, and slowly started excavating that area and moving from right to left towards a fence line where there had been a fence that the current property owner had erected in that area that had a gate. And as we were sweeping across and digging that area, Nuno and I were watching the operator, and you could see that it was hard, you know, and again, you could tell and hear by the tractor that it was struggling in certain areas. And as it's moving along from right to left, it's hard and hard and hard. And then all of a sudden it starts to get, you can see the tractor's digging deeper into the ground and a little bit deeper. So the soil is becoming softer because it had been disturbed. And at one point, as it's coming across, the operator takes a scoop out and then moves the bucket back. And Nuno and I stand up and walk towards this area, because again, we could tell that it was getting more soft in this area. And as we're walking towards it, Nuno looks down, I look down, and before I can say anything, Nuno yells at the backhoe operator to stop. One of the last scoops had unearthed one of a bone that turned out to be Christy Wilson. And so immediately we froze the backhoe operator, we stopped, and we reached out to the GPR. We initially reached out to one of the local agencies, Chico State, that handles cases, but because of all the fires in the area, and there was a lot of bodies, unfortunately, that had burned up in some of the fires, and they were out trying to identify the remains at different locations. We tried to have them come out and assist us because, again, we didn't know that it was human remains. We were very hopeful at the time that it was human remains. So Nuno at that point reached out to the GPR people and contacted one of them. Was an anthropologist, the owner of the company. And we asked her to come out, and immediately she jumped in her car and was at our location within 30 minutes. She showed up, we pointed to the area. As she's walking over to it, she stops on the pavement, looks down, and immediately says, "That is absolutely human remains. You have definitely found human remains." So at that point, we basically again froze the scene. We contacted the Placer County Sheriff's Department. We brought out their evidence division, and the evidence division, along with the anthropologists, slowly started the excavation process.
How long did that process take to get all the remains out?
It took almost 7 hours because the excavation, again, was slow, using brushes, very small tools. We, at that point, just had one bone. And so the process was slow, deliberate, again, led by Cindy, the owner of the GPR company, who's an anthropologist. So the process was slow. Don and I actually very early on reached out to Morgan. We had a sheriff's detective who'd reached out to the sheriff and got to push that information to them extremely quickly. So Don and I weren't there through the entire process because we left, which I'm sure we'll get to here. But it was about a 7 hour process.
Okay. So how many, I want to kind of get to this, how many bones were found in this, where you guys identified that initial one?
Initially, it was just one bone. It was Christy's femur bone. And once the process was complete, we had 99% of the bones in a human body.
Morgan, when you found out, you know, what did, for you as a prosecutor, a parent, a member of your community, how did you feel finding out that they'd found remains?
It was incredible. I was hopeful. I mean, the amount of work that Nuno and Don had put in, and our thoughts that she was on that property, and Nuno and Don's intuition about where to look, I was very hopeful. Immediately, my mind started going into how soon will the media pick up on this, and how soon can we get Don and Nuno to Debbie? Because I knew the minute they found her, the clock was ticking before this information was going to get beyond our control. We had already planned that as soon as we could confirm that it was Christy, and in my mind, as soon as we could confirm that they were female bones and not, you know, ancient Native American burial site, as soon as we knew what this was, I wanted them on a plane. And the most incredible part was we have Nuno and Don, who have spent a decade and a half searching for Christy. And now I'm telling them, you got to leave her and go tell Debbie. And the last place, the last thing Nuno and Don wanted to do was leave Christy. They wanted to be there the whole time. And the only time I ever kind of had to get sort of direct order-ish was it's time to go, because they didn't want to leave. And it was a very surreal, emotional moment for everyone. I mean, particularly for Nuno and Don, who have spent their careers doing this. And I had to tell them, you got to get on a plane. Now's the time. It's going to be midnight by the time they get there. And God forbid the news pick up on this. So time to go. And it was incredibly difficult for them to leave Christy, which is just a testament to their humanity throughout this entire process.
So when did you guys get on that plane?
So we found the first bone, I believe, around 2 o'clock on that Thursday. And logistics were happening in the background, and we got on our flight roughly at about 7 o'clock. And when we got on that flight, the only information that Don and I knew at the time, because there's still the team is excavating, is that we knew we had human remains, and that's all we knew until we landed and we got more information at that point. And by the way, let me say that on this flight was Don, myself, and Detective Madison from the Placer County Sheriff's Office, who was with us. When we were out on the property, there was only three of us there because we kept this pretty small. So the three of us got on a plane and flew out to Scottsdale, Arizona.
And then, so Don, you guys arrived there, what time, 11 o'clock or so?
Yeah, we arrived, the plane landed. We were very fortunate. There was a large storm in the area. A lot of flights got diverted. So I think it was divine intervention. So we were able to actually land. We got there about 12 o'clock, 11:30, 12 o'clock, rented a car. and immediately headed over to Debbie's residence, Debbie and Pat's residence.
Before you got to her house, you mentioned you got some more information. What was the additional information you guys got?
So once we landed, our phones came on. The first text message was from the folks working the evidence, and they had told us that they knew at this point that it was female, a white or female in approximately in their 20s to 30s. So now we had a little bit more specific information. We had more photos because at this point they had already unearthed the majority of the bones. We had two concerns. One was that we wanted to make sure that the message that we were given Debbie and her family is that we had located human remains on Garcia's property and that they were probably female in their 20s. We did not want to tell her that we had found Christy because we didn't have that information. In fact, I think I called you, Anne-Marie, and asked you about using some rapid DNA to get this answer a little quicker than going through the traditional bone DNA match through DOJ. So anyways, that was our thing. We also had a concern that Pat had had surgery and he had just come out of surgery a couple of days. In my mind, I was wanting to stage medical. I was really concerned that we would show up and cause some stress. He was really just a day out of surgery. So those were the things going through our mind as we did the half hour drive from the airport to Debbie's house.
The one of the other things that we had also we wanted to be clear on was we had received information that the one of the from the anthropologist that the kneecap area was had a lot of damage on it and it wasn't really consistent with a female of that age between 20s and 30s. And you know, fortunately, because Noon and I had gotten a chance to get to know the family so well and also with the history of the case, we knew that Christy was very active, that she had, I believe, was a gymnast or definitely in cheerleading and was very active. And once we had discussed that with anthropologists or let them know that, then it started again. That was another piece to the puzzle. But we also had some concerns because of Mario's past and how some of the things that we had known and had done that, you know, could it be somebody else? And I mean, you know, that seemed very unlikely. But, you know, in regards to the search that day, you know, after we found the human remains in that area, we had the excavator still go out and excavate those other five sites. Right. Even during that day, while we were still, while the team was conducting the removal of Christy to make sure that there wasn't any other bodies on his property. Again, because we didn't know. And we needed to convey to the Debbie and Pat that, you know, we found human remains. Everything points to being Christy based on the information we have, but we can't tell you that it's for sure her. And that was very hard to do.
We were anxious driving up to the house. I'll tell you that.
Oh, I can only imagine. So Debbie, let me ask you this. So you know, a month earlier, you told a homicide detective that you just wanted to be told in person. It's midnight in Arizona and you get this knock on the door and it's been 14 years since your daughter went missing. So just kind of walk the listeners through what it was like to answer the door.
Well, gosh, I had been on a late night call with my employer and had went into our family room and had actually fallen asleep in the recliner. And Pat is the one that heard the doorbell. And poor guy, he'd just come home from the hospital. So he ends up getting out of bed and he goes and he answers the door. And at that point, they didn't come in and they wanted to talk to me. And so Pat came over, he said, somebody's at the door. And I got up and I looked and it's amazing how all of us have known each other for this 15 years. But seeing the investigators at my door, it was like I was in the middle of a dream. And at one point it was either Dawn or Nuno that had to say, it's Merch. It's Merch. And like, what are you guys doing here? And then they came in and I looked at them, I said, did you find her? And I actually saw tears in their eyes. And I went, oh my God, you found her. You found her. And they were very clear that they couldn't say 100%, but they were 90% or so. And I said, listen, one thing I do know about Merch, Don, is that he doesn't fly. He doesn't like to fly on airplanes. And so it must be her, because you would not fly on an airplane and be here. And they came in, and a lot of tears. I was in shock, absolute shock. And it's weird what happens when you get this news, because the first thing I wanted was to get to Christy. In my mind, I was hearing it was Christy. And I just wanted to get to her. And so they had to let me know that, you know, again, it wasn't 100%, but they were pretty darn sure. And so it was weird. I all of a sudden I said, just one second. And I did something so bizarre. I had went into one of our spare rooms and pulled out this sign that happened to have been at a vigil from many years ago that said missing, not forgotten. And I put that up in the kitchen. I said, look at this. Look at this. We've never given up hope. And right. And then I think I got some pictures, but I don't know. I was just in utter shock. And the very next, eventually they left. It had to have been 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the morning. And the other thing that I wanted to do was get to my daughter, Stacy, because the last thing that I wanted is for something to appear on the news and my daughter, Stacy, hear that her sister has been found through the news. So immediately I told the investigators, I need to get to San Jose, California. I need to get there. And one thing I have to say is, I think it was the greatest act of compassion that a victim's family could have ever received, for these guys to have literally gotten on a plane, for Placer County to have authorized them to fly to Scottsdale, Arizona, where at the time Pat and I were, to tell us in person. It meant the world to me. And then in my mind, I thought, this has got to be Christy. And so they left. And in the meantime, Pat and I were frantically trying to get me on one of the first flights out of Phoenix to San Jose. And we got a call from the investigators again, and they said Pat said, Debbie, they are coming by, they need more pictures. And I thought, what do they need pictures for? They have our dental records. What do they need? I don't have time to get them pictures, Pat. I need to pack. And so all of a sudden with that, the doorbell rang and there they were. And it had to have been closer to 8 in the morning, and they came in and they confirmed at that point that they received confirmation that 100% it was confirmed that these remains were Christie's. Wow. And oh my gosh.
Well, I think just listening to you and I mean, Dawn and Nuno, I mean, looking at you, even though the listeners can't see, this has got to be, you know, it's 15 years and it still is obvious to me the emotion that the two of you have, and I'm sure Morgan as well. I mean, I know because Morgan called me the morning that you know, this all happened, and Debbie, you and I talked, and I mean, for you, Dawn and Nuno, I mean, what's it like for you to pursue this for so long and then finally have that moment to be able to say you actually found her?
Is this actually Christy Wilson, the person we've grown to know postmortem, obviously? And it was a very surreal moment. My daughter was born in 2005, and I kept thinking, I cannot ever imagine what it would be like not to know where your child is at. And that conversation, Dawn and I had a conversation over 15 years, and that drove us. The strength that Debbie and her family have, that supported us. And so when we were standing in Debbie's kitchen in the middle of the night there, while we were in a task mode of delivering the message, the right message. As Debbie mentioned, there's a lot of emotion going on. We are finally, hopefully, bringing home Christy where she belongs with her family. And so it is surreal, gives me the chills to talk about it right now. And that continues on. They're a very strong family, and we appreciate so much the love that they've shown for us and how strong that they are.
Yeah, for me, I remember, you know, sitting there or standing there and seeing, like, you know, it said the first bone that was unearthed, and getting in there, and because we were there for part of the excavation, and you know, from that bone, we were able to start pedestaling and finding, and as more were unearthed, and as Nuna said, just being there and helping remove her, it was very emotional, the first thing for me. I felt like I was recovering a family member. Real quick, when I say a family member, I felt like I was recovering my own family member, because we had gotten to know her so well.
Yeah, it was incredible. It didn't take long in knowing Debbie to feel as if you knew Christy as well. She was very much an alive being in our heads that we were still trying to find. And I think the community reflected that as well in the days and months. Yeah. And to this day, we get just sort of random communications from the community saying, what an inspirational moment that was. In the midst of all this tragedy, at least a little bit of light shone through, and watching Nuno and Don and Debbie's relationship through all of this was inspiring from a career prosecutor that, you know, we're used to the day to day and we're used to the sadness and we're used to getting the job done. But to see a moment like this is, I think, pretty unique in all of our careers to share in this moment. And I was just incredibly proud to have shared a small sliver of it with this incredible group.
You called me the morning that she was found, and it's one of those moments for me, probably like all of you, like, I'm not going to forget where I was standing, and your words were, there's something I need to talk to you about. And I instantly said, you found her. And it was a moment for me that I felt so much relief for Debbie and Pat and your daughter Stacy, that I just, you know, from my perspective, this is the greatest example of the dedication of public safety to pursue not just justice, but to bring her home. I mean, 15 years, it's quite remarkable, Debbie.
It is. And I have to say, our lives have changed in such a positive way. You know, it has brought a peace to my family and I that we just didn't have. It ended 15 years of torment. And my husband, at one point, he was interviewed, and then we were also at a dinner, and Dawn and Nuno were present, and my husband thanked them again for all the effort in bringing Christy home and the peace that they brought to their family. But when Pat said, and thank you for bringing my wife back as well, it's something he hadn't ever communicated to me, and I just looked at him and he was just so tearful. And so, I mean, truly, it was a gift that they've given our family that I will forever, forever be grateful for.
Right. One thing I think I want to make sure that the listeners understand, because, you know, one question people might have is, well, okay, you found her on his property. What was it that, you know, why wasn't she found then? And what was it about the GPR, the ground penetrating radar, that changed the dynamics of this whole case?
Well, I can touch on that a little bit. The Sheriff's Department did a phenomenal job in 2005 of putting a lot of resources into searching Mario's property. There were dogs, there were searchers, there was grid searches, detailed searches of the area. Mario was a key player in this thing. He had information as to where she was. And not only that, he had spread bark and landscaping throughout the entire property to make it look like he had just worked on his property. 4.5 acres, everything looks uniform. very difficult. The dogs didn't hit on anything. And what really changed for Donna and I in the investigation was talking again with Mario's family and getting that information that Mario was on that tractor, that Mario, again, to them, that wasn't significant, to us it was. And the we had all the puzzle pieces and they were on the table, but there were a couple puzzle pieces that just didn't fit until July of 2020. And the pieces started to fit a little bit better. And using the ground penetrating radar with the mentality that we wanted to search this property and leave it in 2020 with the best technology we had available to us. And the ground penetrating radar giving us those eyes underground was a big part as well. So it was a combination of Mario's family, the technology, Morgan coming on and giving us the time and the budget to bring Christy home to the family. That all played into this formula for us being able to put all the puzzle pieces and get a clear picture of what happened to Christy and where she was.
So as we kind of wrap this up, I want to just kind of bring it all back to this concept that, you know, without this pursuit by you all in 2005, without the forensic evidence and all the circumstantial evidence, you know, this went to trial as a nobody homicide. He was convicted. And without all of you pursuing this for 15 years and without the advancement of that technology, I'm very confident that you would never have found her.
There was one postscript that I wanted to add. The question after she was found was, what do we do about Mario? And Nuno and Don, the only time we disagreed, they wanted to go down and tell him and say, we found him. And I appreciated that moment. And the only thing I said was, no, let him find out a couple of days from now, third hand from his cellmate. This is not his moment. What he deserves is anonymity. He deserves not to be part of this equation, because what this whole process has taught us and this whole thing is about Christy and her family. And that's how this final chapter of this terrible story needs to end, is about Christy and the hope that this represents. And that's my final thought, is what Nuno and Don and Debbie and her wonderful family have shown is hope to other investigators, hope to other families, hope hopefully in the form of public trust in our public safety, and that we give our lives and our souls and everything we have to these jobs. And Nuno and Don are living proof of that, and that they will stop at nothing, and that this is a calling. And in these terrible times in the news where we hear things in about public safety, these are the moments that represent who the people are that work in these professions, and this is what they do, and this is who they are. And the support from Debbie and her family has demonstrated just the goodness in all the players here.
For me, to be honest with you, I feel a little bit lost at times, because we were so focused on trying to find her. And that was so important to me. I had spoken to Debbie during our classes and on the phone, and told her that I was basically not going to retire until we found her. And fortunately, we were able to find her before I retired. So I'm very grateful of that. The biggest impact that has for me, though, is in meeting Debbie and Pat and Stacy, was I could see that they were hurting. And I had said to them that I wish we could change the circumstances of our meeting and how we met. Unfortunately, we can't do that, but I'm so grateful to have them as friends and people that we were able to help. And as I mentioned, when we first met Debbie and Pat and Stacy, is you could just see that this Christy was missing piece in their heart, and they were hurting so much. And Debbie and Pat and Stacy are you can see they're happy again. And that to me is the greatest impact for me, is to just realize that we were able to finally bring her home and bring some peace back to their family.
I hate talking after Morgan. He's such an eloquent speaker. Look, every detective, every investigator in their career has a defining case, a case that sticks with them through their career. This absolutely was that case. It's been said, you know, we maintained hope. Christy maintained on the forefront of our mind, even though we'd moved on to other cases. Christy was with us. The strength that Debbie and her family, I can't say that enough, the strength that they gave us and the motivation and the drive that they gave us to not stop until we were able to bring Christy home was tremendous and still is. Debbie, shortly after finding Christy, had said to me, I want to give hope to other families. I want other detectives who have cases like this to continue searching, to see that it's possible to at some point bring a loved one home, even though they're not with us. And Debbie still maintains that that motivation and that drive. She shares her story with other detectives. She shares her story with other victims' families. And that gives me that strength and hope to continue to share the same story with other detectives, to never give up and do it for those who can no longer speak. That's part of what we do in homicide cases is speak for those victims and give those families the justice and the peace that they so much deserve. I am absolutely moved by Debbie's family. I'm so honored to be part of their lives. As Don said, I wish I'd met them under different circumstances, but they show a lot of love. And yeah, this case was to this day has moved and has changed the way that I do my work and live my life.
Thank you. Debbie, final thoughts? Yeah.
Yes, you know, I always think about just the perseverance. I mean, really, this is the greatest example of perseverance in investigative work. All of you speak to the strength that our family exhibited. And truly, it was the investigators and Placer County that provided us the strength. Because, you know, it, throughout the years, I would periodically get a phone call when one of the investigators was driving home at night from work. I could tell they were at end of their day. And just to check in, they didn't have an update. They just were checking in. And what that told me was they haven't forgotten. Christy's still in their minds. This case is still in their minds. No, they don't have any new leads, but they haven't forgotten. And that just gave me another shot of, you know, of hope and strength. And I sincerely appreciated that all along the way. And, you know, again, we've talked about, you know, how well we all had engaged. Not always did we always agree. And there were times, especially in the very beginning, and then periodically, you know, when Garcia started writing letters and things, that I wasn't the easiest person to deal with. I know that. But they respectfully granted me the grace at that time without putting up a barrier and saying, I'm not going to talk to her again. Where, you know, if I look back on some of my own behaviors at times or moods, they very easily could have done that as a kind of human nature, but they didn't. And that meant the world because we're not always going to be on our best game and in the best mood throughout these, you know, long process. And for all of us to have recognized that and taken a pause when we needed to, I think really contributed to the strength of our entire engagement with one another throughout all these years. And again, I just want to reiterate my gratitude for the peace that you've brought our family. And truly, their work has really given hope to other families because ever since Christy was found, there are a number of no-body homicide cases within the state of California where I am hearing from families asking, how did you guys all build the rapport? This is what's happened. What do you think? And there are other families that have really been inspired and had that another shot of hope that it is possible to have good relationships with investigators throughout the years. So thank you guys for what you've given to other families that are walking this horrific journey as well.
Well, I just want to just wrap this up by saying thank you to all of you for not just for the pursuit of justice and convicting the man that murdered Christy, but the pursuit of finding her so she could come home. So for you, Don Murchison, thank you. Nuno Tavares, thank you. Morgan Geyer, thank you. And Debbie Boyd, thank you so much.
Emery, thank you for allowing us to share our story and be on this podcast with you. You are a leader in our community, and you are definitely one of the folks that has been part of our strength over the years. So thank you for your guidance and leadership and friendship over the years.
And thank you for launching this podcast and for having us on today to share this story. It means the world to me, and thank you for your friendship.
I'll go next. Thank you very much, Anne-Marie, for letting me join this this wonderful podcast, and thank you for doing this series. This is important information for our community, and we really appreciate your leadership. You obviously have been a mentor and a friend to me all along, and I wouldn't be in this position without you, and I would have met these great folks without your support. So it's an honor to be here today, and thank you for doing this series. I greatly appreciate it.
And Anne-Marie, I want to thank you too. I, you know, reach out to you for guidance. You're incredibly knowledgeable. I appreciate your series, your podcast series, and for having us on the show today.
For the listeners out there, I hope you keep listening to these podcasts. You can find us on insidecrimefiles.com and listen to more about the true consequences of crime and the innovation and inspiration that comes out of these cases. So I just thank you all.
I am Anne-Marie Schubert, and this is Inside the Crime Files.